A letter will arrive from a place where your reply can't be sent. That you're already here. That you've already left you.
I was unlucky enough to get caught out in the biggest storm ever recorded in Bass Strait in 1975, in June 75, and it was off the Beaufort scale. Beaufort scale goes to 12, force 12. We estimate it was force 15, which is 200 k's an hour for 5 days. And we had 90 foot seas, and we feared for our life.
We heard from lawn surfer and ice cream shop owner, Barry Langan, who goes by the nickname Tubes, in our first episode. Tubes is recalling his terror as he tried to keep his ship afloat in one of the roughest, most dangerous stretches of water in the world.
You've got 6,000 metres of, you know, Southern Ocean coming up to the continental slope into Bass Strait, and it's, you know, it's like a narrow gap for the Southern Ocean going into the Tasman Sea, Pacific Ocean, you know, and it's funnels, and the wind funnels, everything funnels because it hits the land, it comes from the Antarctic and funnels through. If we veered off directly perpendicular angle to these 90-foot waves, we were gone, we were history.
It took 5 days before the storm blew itself out and for Tubes and his crew to make it home. Fast forward to April 2003. Master Sun and his crew had just been through their own 5-day ocean ordeal, not too far from Bass Strait. They'd been on the run in heavy seas for 4 days before they were overpowered by the Australian military on the Easter weekend.
Common Sue, if you do not stop your vessel or alter course, we will stop your vessel, or the Australian government will stop your vessel using any method available.
No, he's making a run for it.
Motor vessel Pong Su, this is Australian warship. I intend to board you. Over.
Now in custody, the North Koreans were beginning to see that things work differently in Australia.
The crew thought we brought him off, and then we actually took him out the back and shot him.
Despite their fears, Master Sun hadn't been shot when he was taken off the Pong Su. He was being treated for his heart problems. The captured Pong Su crew and the drug syndicate members Lee, Lam and Teng, who'd been arrested on shore, now faced a big test. Would they keep quiet to protect the hidden architects of the drug import? Or would they make a deal and talk to save themselves?
Yes, I fully recall it. It is a very big narcotic operation by Australian government.
I'm talking to a man called Thay Yong Ho over Skype. He's in Seoul, South Korea. Thay remembers the 2003 Pong Su incident well. Back then, he was a rising star in Kim Jong-il's North Korean diplomatic corps. Thay was from a famous revolutionary family. Like the crew on the Pong Su, he was among the few North Koreans trusted to travel overseas. Today, Thay is perhaps one of the most high-profile North Korean defectors in the world.
A deputy ambassador from North Korea has defected to South Korea, according to the Unification Ministry.
He absconded to the West from North Korea's London embassy in 2016. This puts him at the top of Kim Jong-un's hit list.
And disappeared from his residence in West London last month. Thay Yong Ho's
defection. If North Korea's agents could find Thay, they'd almost certainly kill him. I was keen to talk to Thay about the shadowy North Korean agency I believe was involved in the Pong Su heroin shipment.
The Division of 39 is established and is running for the raising the money for the Kim family. This is party organization, and they run a huge network of foreign currency shop in North Korea. They have a lot of coal or gold mines or refineries in North Korea. So actually, they have a really huge economic network in North Korea.
Division 39, also known as Bureau 39, Room 39, or Office 39, is one of the most important government agencies in North Korea. Division 39 gets its name from the third floor office it occupies in a Pyongyang building that is reportedly easy to reach from a nearby Kim family residence. Through an opaque mix of legal, semi-legal, and illicit businesses, it's said to generate half to $2 billion US a year. Among Division 39's most famous products were high-quality US banknote forgeries, known as supernotes, which the US Treasury at the time had to acknowledge were pretty damn good.
Criminal conduct, counterfeiting United States currency. Those of you who've ever seen the supernote know just how effective they are at counterfeiting the United States $100 bill.
Basically, Division 39 is a slush fund for a ruling family with expensive tastes. They indulge these while ordinary people starve in a country crippled by economic sanctions.
Yearly spending on luxury goods for North Korea's leader.
The plane features crystal ashtrays, a bedroom,
and a running track, a large pool with a giant water slide, horse stables and a riding area, a shooting range and a horse track.
Actually, they do not mind what kind of methods they use. The money is the most important thing for Kim family, and there is no any moral in it.
Back in 2003, North Korea's then leader, Kim Jong-il, had the world worried.
North Korea has moved to the top of the agenda with its announcement today it is withdrawing from the International Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, the treaty that governs the dissemination of nuclear weapons. It's the latest and most dramatic move by the North since it was discovered that that renegade regime is trying to produce additional nuclear weapons.
America and its allies reacted by increasing their focus on North Korea's alleged illicit activities, many thought to be directed by Division 39. As well as filling the Kim family's coffers, Division 39 is thought to be a major source of funds for North Korea's weapons programs.
North Korea has an established record of selling weapons technology, widely and indiscriminately, obviously.
Accounts of North Korean diplomats smuggling drugs go back to the 1970s.
Sky News investigations uncovered evidence that North Korean government officials are involved in trafficking drugs. Heroin, methamphetamine and ecstasy are being smuggled over the country's border.
The US State Department in 2004 estimated up to 50 North Korean diplomats had been caught up in drug trafficking. But nothing matched the scale of the Pongsu incident off the coast of Sleepy Little Lawn in 2003. Federal police detective and Pongsu case officer Celeste Johnston.
This was unique in the fact that they're no longer just using small amounts through diplomatic channels and using their diplomats to facilitate those imports. This was going to be something that was going to be a new methodology.
If the North Korean ship's trip to Australia was state-sponsored or even state-sanctioned, it's a good bet Division 39 was somehow involved. To the US, the Pongsu looked like the perfect example of the Kim regime upping the stakes. It was seized upon by one of the world's most influential men, the then US Secretary of State, Colin Powell, just weeks after the action at Boggley Creek.
North Korea is exporting not only missiles, but as we saw in an Australian bus the other day, drugs. So this is a regime that thrives in criminality.
The Pongsu also had the Australian government fired up. Australia's then Foreign Affairs Minister, Alexander Downer, was suspicious about the discovery of a North Korean political secretary on the Pongsu and what this could mean.
Of course, criminal elements do this from all over the world, but if there was proof that another government or the political party, which is the governing party of another country, is involved in drug trafficking, that would be a matter of complete outrage.
And North Korea? What was its reaction? It was 17 days after the Pongsu was captured by Australia before Kim Jong-il's regime said anything public. A statement released by its Foreign Affairs Department denied any link with the ship or the drugs. Such a suggestion was, I quote, a US-inspired smear campaign and false propaganda. According to the North Koreans, the Pongsu was privately owned, and no one in the government had any idea why it was in Australia or what it was doing. Whether this private ownership claim was true or not, Master Sun and his crew now had an official position to stick to, and they would at all costs. Their government was not to be linked in any way to the business of the Pong Su. Now, I don't know whether anything could be truly privately owned in North Korea in 2003, or even today. So I asked Dae, the defector, about it.
No, in North Korea, it is a socialist system. So there is no any private ownership. You can't even have a small corner shop in North Korea. The real estate, whatever, all those means of productions are the state ownership. So there can't be any kind of private ownership of that kind of big, the ship like Pong Su.
I got a call from someone who was able to get my number. I won't explain who they were, but basically then asked me what my security clearance was. And I told him, and obviously it wasn't high enough for him to even talk to me. And then he asked, well, what's going on?
Federal police boss Des Appleby is talking about a phone call he received the night of the botched heroin drop at Boggley Creek. It was from someone who had access to the highest levels of Australian intelligence, way higher than Des. The call is significant because it came before police had identified the Pong Su as North Korean. This phone call, along with the military aircraft that would appear out of the blue the next morning, makes me pretty convinced that agencies other than the Australian Federal Police knew about the ship as she made her journey here through Southeast Asia. With the Pong Su crew now in custody, first in Sydney and then in various prisons around Melbourne, police and other agencies turned their attention to the most mysterious man from the boat, political secretary Choi Dong-song.
So a political secretary has no role on a vessel. Certainly has a role in North Korean society in terms of ensuring allegiance to the government.
Choi Dong-song was a member of the Workers' Party of Korea. As we heard in episode 2, his job was to watch, listen, and record who did what on board the Pong Su. But some people thought his role was a lot more important than that. In the course of researching this story, I came across some material that has never been reported publicly before. They're documents showing Australian investigators were viewing political secretary Choi as a possible North Korean intelligence operative, one most likely connected to Division 39, the money-making engine for the Kim family. I asked Des about his first impressions of Choi the day he boarded the captured Pong Su as it was being brought into Sydney Harbour.
The political guy, he was a very measured, capable person, someone who's used to being in a controlling situation.
Right from when the Pong Su was first seized, police were treating Choi as someone as equally important as Master Sun. When the Master was off getting medical treatment, it was Choi who was served by police with a seizure warrant for the ship.
The vessel, Pong Su.
Okay, could you please state his name for the audio tape, please?
이름을 말씀하세요.
최동성입니다.
Choi told police through an interpreter that he was not allowed to keep such documents, so the warrant was placed in his property bag.
1944년 2월 26일입니다.
26th of February.
Des tried to talk to Choi in the days after the Pong Su was seized, but soon got the feeling he was wasting his time.
He was quite smug and said, you'll never link it to us. So that was what he was intimating. So as any normal criminal would do, just, why would you make it easy for the cops?
Indeed, the entire crew seemed to be sticking to a tight script.
They certainly had 4 days to think about what would happen. And so they'd obviously devised stories, and they obviously did their very best to make sure that there was nothing on board the vessel.
It was a few days before Master Sun was well enough to talk to police.
The owner of the vessel is Pong Su.
Shipping company.
And whereabouts are they located?
그 봉수 회사는 어디에 있습니까?
평양에 있습니다.
In Pyongyang.
That's a Korean interpreter giving Master Sun's answers to police in English. I can't help but kind of admire the composure he displayed in his answers.
And can we send a copy of these documents to the Pongsu Shipping Company?
이 지금 설명드린 증서를 봉수 선박회사에 보낼 수 있습니까?
나로서는 네가 지금 여기 억류되어 있기 때문에 보낼 수 없습니다.
I can't send it because I am arrested here.
Okay. Does he have a contact number for Pongsu?
난 나이 먹어서 잘 모르겠는데 우리가 통역이 알 수 있고 이 봉수 선박회사 사장이 아마 내가 주관적 판단하면 오늘 아니면 내일 아침에 아마 여기 도착할 겁니다.
I am too old to remember those. However, the owner of the Pongsu Shipping Company, a person will be arriving in Australia today or tomorrow, and he might know.
Okay. Does he know that person's name?
그분의 성함을 아십니까?
김춘남.
김순.
춘남.
춘남. 네. 춘.
네. 봉춘자가.
Remember that name, Kim Chu Nam, the man who Master Sun said was the owner of the Pongsu. Before the police switched off their tape recorder, Master Sun had a question of his own to ask via his interpreter.
선박 선원들을 응리하는가 그게 좀 의문되는데.
One thing I have a doubt, I do not understand why the Australian government seized vessel and the crews.
Des realised no one from the Pongsu was going to be particularly helpful. For starters, Master Sun, Political Secretary Choi and the rest of the crew were adamant that the two men who'd brought the heroin ashore at Boggley Creek, Wong and the guy who drowned, had never been on board the Pongsu. We heard in our second episode that they had in fact boarded the Pongsu, most likely at a place called Sister Island near the ship's home port of Nampo in North Korea. But even when police told the crew paint from the Pongsu's deck had been matched to flecks found on the shoes worn by Wong and the other guy, everyone from the master down maintained they'd never seen the pair. None of the crew knew anything about any drugs either. And as for not stopping when requested by police, well, the North Koreans said they were worried about pirates.
Yeah, so they're absolutely lying about that and, you know. But yeah, they had time to put their stories together. The whole crew stuck to a story, a script, which didn't include the two extras.
The North Korean embassy in Canberra wasn't being helpful either. Reporter Marianne Jolly was able to get a few questions into the North Korean ambassador at the time.
Have you been expelled from Australia?
Why?
Was your government involved in drug smuggling into Australia?
No.
Not at all?
Not at all.
We had some engagement with the North Korean embassy people, and they would stand literally face to face with, in one circumstance with myself, just in a very loud, clear voice, telling me how much they hated the police.
I've learned that the North Korean diplomat sitting in on Choi's interrogation became restless when the matter of intelligence services were brought up, tapping his feet and banging his knees. Political Secretary Choi said he didn't even know what an intelligence agency was.
Tell him that we're just explaining to him the reason why we are here. Police are going to make inquiries into the allegation that we believe he was involved in heroin importation.
副总, 巴斯波,
I was from the village and when I saw some policemen, I became afraid because I didn't have a passport.
常在山里啊?
I was scared and so I hid myself in the hill.
Police weren't getting any straight answers from Wong either about why he was hiding in the Great Ocean Road hills or about the identity of the man he'd buried at the beach. The story Wong was spinning was that neither he nor the dead man had any friends or family back home. His story was so vague that police in 2019 remain uncertain as to whether Wong is North Korean, Chinese, or something else. Even the men who'd been caught pretty much red-handed importing heroin, Lam, Lee, and Teng, weren't playing ball. Apparently they believed the consequences of talking would be worse than staying silent. Remember, international crime bosses make it their business to know where the families of their foot soldiers live. Talking puts your loved ones in peril. And the crew of the Pong Su had their own fears. Each had family back in North Korea who could face terrible retribution if their relatives stepped out of line. I asked Des what he knew about these two groups, the crime syndicate and the North Koreans, and how they came to work together.
We got an understanding of that at that time there were North Koreans throughout Asia that had direct links into organised crime in places like Bangkok, for example, and other places, Cambodia. So these North Koreans were directly engaged with organised crime, and often they were looking at ways to make money to send back to North Korea. So that's really what it was about. It was about trying to find ways, either legitimate or illegitimate ways, to make money for the motherland.
Again, these arrangements bore the hallmarks of North Korea's Division 39. I had one other question for Des. What's it like as a police officer when you know you're being straight up lied to?
Sometimes the truth won't set you free. It's part of our daily trade is people won't cooperate with us. So we actually assume that most people won't tell us what happened. So we've got to prove it.
Des and his team soon charged Lee, Lam, Wong and Teng with heroin trafficking. And all 30 crew from the Pong Su were charged with aiding and abetting the heroin importation. We'll get into the marathon legal battle later. For all the misinformation coming from the men in custody, police did have one item they knew wouldn't lead them astray.
When we located the GPS, it was quite a huge win.
Police found the GPS device on Wong when they eventually caught him hiding in the scrub above Boggley Creek. Lam had given him the GPS that stormy night when everything went pear-shaped. The GPS was meant to be Wong's lifeline as he huddled alone on the foreshore, waiting to see if he could get back to his ship. Back in 2003, it was pretty unusual to find this type of technology on ordinary punters the way it is now with smartphones.
But it was the GPS that ultimately was the undoing. That's what this has really started to open up to something so much bigger.
That's Tim James, the Victoria Police Search and Rescue Sergeant who tracked Wong to his hideout. With the GPS, police were able to trace all of Lam's movements right up until the point he passed the GPS to Wong. This included his use of the back road into Lawn through the Otway Rainforest from the rural township of Dean's Marsh.
For instance, it took us to the car park at Lawn. More importantly, was it took us up to back up into
Dean's
toward
Marsh.
Dean's Marsh. Yeah, it took us to this location. So we walked down into the bush and it was really scrubby. You wouldn't have gone there for no other reason. And it was as accurate as 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, we're here. And we all looked at our feet and there was a great pile of stuff. There were passport photos. There was torn up documents. There was letterheads from the Pong Su Shipping Company. Like, it was all really good stuff. And all these passport photos were perfect because they were from the villains that were caught. You know, it was just, from an evidentiary point of view, really exciting stuff.
The GPS confirmed that Lam had stopped en route to Boggley Creek on the night of the heroin import and thrown into the roadside scrub photographs and documents linking him to the Pong Su. But Des still had a big problem.
Where was the missing packages? We were expecting more. They're not there.
When Lee and Teng were arrested, they only had 50 kilograms of heroin on them, yet the listening device in their car had captured them talking repeatedly about 150 kilograms.
There's six bags, each bag around.
But you need to know how heavy they are. They're this big. What happens if each bag is 50 kilos?
That's a lot of heroin to be missing.
Police found no drugs on the Pong Su when they searched it after she docked at the Garden Island Naval Base in Sydney Harbour on April 20. By the first week of May, police suspected that one 25-kilogram package might have been lost, perhaps destroyed, when the dinghy bringing it ashore was crushed by a huge wave. Still, police kept returning to Boggley Creek to look for more heroin. In the event one bag had been destroyed, that left another three out there somewhere.
There was a huge search on to find it.
because it's still at 75 kilos, it is the biggest ever seized in Victoria. There was an enormous effort to try and locate it, lots of searching. When we obviously worked with the GPS, there was and with the search and rescue, everyone was working to find the heroin. And we had people down there all the time, just looking, checking, dogs, reconstructing, then working on whatever we could to try and work out what he did.
21 days after the Pong Su appeared along the Great Ocean Road, police made a breakthrough.
If you just look in there, you can just perhaps come in from the angle I'm in this side.
Yep.
You can see here where one package ends and the second, I don't know if the camera picks it up, but the second package appears to start around here.
Yeah.
Police had just found the three plastic-wrapped packages Lamb had taken in his blue Ford Focus and hidden in the bush near Boggley Creek the night of the drop.
Oh, yeah.
Ever since I started looking into the Pong Su story, two questions have nagged away. Who were Lee, Lamb and Teng going to give the heroin to? And why didn't police let them run with the drugs to lead them to the big fish behind the massive heroin deal?
But first this morning, police in Melbourne are on high alert as a war between two underworld families intensifies.
Back in 2003, Melbourne's underworld was in the middle of a bloody war to determine who was in control of the city's lucrative drug trade.
In broad daylight, Jason Moran and another small-time criminal were gunned down in front of their children and dozens of...
Gangsters were being shot dead with alarming regularity.
With a crime family patriarch shot dead in front of his home. And just hours later, two other men were gunned down.
Charges, admitting he was the general in charge of a vast drug empire.
But the feuding drug bosses, like the Morans, Carl Williams and Tony Mockbell, were more interested in ecstasy pills than bags of heroin. Here's Federal Police Detective Celeste Johnston on where the heroin was most likely bound for.
At the time, the intelligence said the ultimate destination was going to be Sydney. So inquiries were obviously pursued, but nothing we could ever prove or continue further.
That's fascinating. Why do you reckon they chose, if it was end destination Sydney, why Great Ocean Road?
I have no idea. And it still surprises me to this day why they would choose the shipwreck coast to stop their ship.
As for not waiting for Lee, Teng and Lamb to pass on the heroin to their Australian contacts, Des had a pretty reasonable response.
We'd already lost them the night before, and ultimately I couldn't ensure that I could take it to the next level without losing it again. We'd love to catch the main guys in Australia who have ordered this stuff. They're the real criminals, the most significant criminals, and the ones that are maintaining Australia's drug problem. So from our perspective, getting the kingpins behind these drug enterprises is number one priority and is a continued focus. But the reality is, can you control it to get to that point? You don't run uncontrolled operations. And if you lose it, the criticism is there, and rightly so in my view. If I lost 50 kilograms of heroin onto this, that's a lot of damage and a lot of deaths.
But as Des knows from half a lifetime of chasing drug bosses, even if he had let the heroin smuggling continue to its next phase, it was highly unlikely he'd be led to the top.
How those groups would operate is that they'd send, again, their foot soldiers down to Geelong to collect the drugs. So we'd catch some other junior person collecting the drugs, or multiple, who then take it back up and store it. So the big boss won't go near the actual narcotics, but they'll arrange for a series of patsies to deal with it, handle it, then deal with the money resulting, and it goes on and on.
And new this hour, evidence that North Korea is flagrantly violating UN sanctions. The Security Council passed several resolutions last year alone that go after the North's commodities.
That's a 2018 report from CNN. 16 years on from the Pong Su, North Korea is still using its shipping fleet to engage in illegal activity to evade international sanctions. These sanctions have long been used by the international community to try to bring the Kim dynasty to heel and give up their nuclear ambitions. And just like the Pongsu changing its flag to that of Tuvalu on the way to Australia, North Korea is still disguising its ships.
The flag you see on the left is no longer there. Hugh Griffith is the coordinator of the UN panel that compiled that report. He comes to
get a better understanding of the economic importance to North Korea of its shipping networks, I spoke to one of the world's foremost experts on the matter, Hugh Griffiths. From 2014 until the end of 2018, Hugh led the United Nations Security Council's panel of experts on North Korea. The panel has produced a series of blockbuster reports about Kim Jong-un's ingenious ways of evading sanctions, particularly via shipping.
So the sanctions regime changed from rather traditional non-proliferation regime covering things like dual-use goods used for WMD, missile parts, conventional arms, and really expanded to cover all manner of commodities as well as other activities such as fishing, guest workers, etc.
Hugh and his seven-person team of experts were able to access some of the very best intelligence material available on North Korea. A lot of this information centered on North Korea's reliance on ships.
Well, although North Korea is portrayed as a very isolated, inward-looking country, the one area where they are not isolated, where they reach out, is through their maritime network, where their own North Korean flagships used to sail all over the world, for example, and many of the other ships which are controlled by North Korea but operate under flags of convenience. Some of them are continuing to sail to different parts of the world, although they're more restricted now in where they can go. So the maritime sector was always one of the main areas where North Korea was vulnerable, because that's where they linked in with the global economy. That's where they interacted at foreign ports, sailed in international waters, was sometimes insured by foreign insurance companies. So they could be touched in ways that assets within North Korea couldn't be. And then, of course, the scale. Everyone can see a ship if you've got access to satellites and automatic information systems.
Zhu first started looking into the Pongsu in 2010 when he was working at the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute to compile a maritime database on the smuggling of arms, narcotics, and what are known as dual-use goods. These are things generally made for civilian use, but also have military applications. Chlorine, for example, is a dual-use good. I asked him about North Korea's proposition that the Pongsu was privately owned.
No, I've certainly never seen any evidence to suggest that these individual shipping companies are in fact privately owned. And this is from researching quite a number of North Korean vessels and the people who own them. It's certainly true that the North Korean state split vessel ownership up into small, often single vessel ownership companies, but that didn't change the fact that these were all state enterprises with, as you say, a North Korean Workers' Party official acting as the political secretary on board the ships.
Hugh enlightened me about what political secretary Choi Dong-song was doing on board the Pongsu.
Well, on the North Korean ships that we inspected, the political secretary's job was to ensure loyalty to the state and to the party on the part of all the crew, and to conduct regular classes, sometimes weekly readings from the various North Korean Workers' Party literature, and to ensure adherence to the regime and no deviation, and to avoid any possibility of defection on the part of any of the crew.
Hugh also had some news for me, news which connected the Pongsu to the present day.
One is Kim Chu-nam, who previously managed the Pongsu Ship Management Company.
We heard the name Kim Chu-nam earlier when Master Sun, speaking through his interpreter, told police that the owner of the Pongsu, Kim Chu-nam, would be coming to Australia very soon.
Kim Chu-nam.
Kim Sun.
Chu-nam.
Chu-nam.
Pongsu.
Now, he was sanctioned by the US far more recently in November 2017 for working. So he's still working in the North Korean shipping industry, and he's the manager of a company called Dawn Marine Management these days. And then there was another chap, a trusted foreign national, who worked together with Kim Chu-nam on the Pongsu, and he was from Taiwan, and his name is Neil Tsang. And he was also very recently designated for an assets freeze by the UN Security Council for other illicit deals in 2018 involving coal with North Korea.
Taiwan man Neil Tsang reportedly sold other vessels to the Pongsu Shipping Company and arranged charters for its ships. In fact, he gave an interview to the Los Angeles Times about the Pongsu in May 2003, telling reporters the Pongsu was owned by North Korea.
So the important thing is that Kim Chu-nam and Neil Tsang remain in contact, just like they were back in 2003 when they were both deeply involved in Pongsu ship management. Fast forward 14 years later, 15 years later, and they've both been designated, one by the US for an assets freeze and a travel ban, and the other by the United Nations for an assets freeze and travel ban for violating the UN sanctions on North Korea, in that they're still doing prohibited deals.
I finished the interview with Hugh by asking perhaps one of the dumbest questions of my journalistic career.
When you were in New York, and particularly when your panel of experts' remit was widened dramatically with those new sanctions in 2016, and, you know, the work you were doing is very high profile, global, significant work, did you ever have any concerns about your own personal security or that of your communications?
What do you think?
I pressed on.
I guess what we're trying to portray to our audience is that this is really serious stuff, and that this is not, you know, not a laughing matter. So what precautions could someone in your role then take to maintain as much personal security as possible?
Well, I wouldn't want to talk about that.
Fair enough. North Korea plays for keeps. For me, it further underscores why no one from the Pongsu or the crime syndicate members like Lee and Teng would entertain talking to police about who had sent them so far from home.
You know, in the communist world, it's all about absolute control, and, you know, it's a way of getting money back to them so as they can finance things, you know, which, you know, they're pretty poor over in North Korea thanks to their regime.
That's Tubes again, veteran seafarer and surfer. He might not be an international expert on geopolitics, but I reckon Tubes has got a pretty good grasp on what's important in life.
They're concerned for human life, but they've got the regimes that control these worlds don't have any care for their own people, you know. This is the bottom line.
Coming up on the last voyage of the Pongsu.
Just aware these people needed some sort of legal help, and I wrote to the embassy, because there's no one else to write to in Australia in relation to North Korea, and we never heard back. 1, 2, 3 weeks later, some people showed up.
He had been previously arrested in Denmark for, I think it was 5.5 kilos, and was imprisoned and then escaped and turned up here some years later.
And I remember thinking, it was that small thing of vanity. They were dyeing their hair. They, in fact, were grey, but they had been one of their small vanities, perhaps small luxuries, was they dyed their hair.
Hi Pongsu fans, we got some great feedback about the bonus episode with former SAS men Tim Curtis and Ben Pronk last week. So we've got another bonus episode for The Age and Sydney Morning Herald subscribers this week about a previously untold part of the Pongsu story. It's an interview with the man entrusted to steer the Pongsu back to Sydney Harbour after she and her crew were captured at sea, former Navy clearance diver Nicholas Martin. Again, look in the episode description in your podcast player for the link.
The Last Voyage of the Pongsu is brought to you by the newsrooms of The Age and the Sydney Morning Herald. To read more and to watch the videos referenced in this episode, head to our websites, While you're there, why not take out a subscription to help power independent Australian journalism and productions like this podcast? If you're enjoying this series, leave a review on iTunes and recommend us to a friend. The Last Voyage of the Pong Su is reported by Richard Baker. Field recording and audio editing by executive producer Rachel Dexter. Narrative consultant is Kate Cole Adams. Siobhan McHugh is consulting producer. Music and composition by Vicky Hansen. Sound design and mixing by John Greenfield. Assistant producer is Margaret Gordon. And Tom McKendrick is head of audio. Thanks to our cast of actors. Chi Kwan Lee is played by Andy Song. Kyung Fa Teng is played by Anthony Ting. And Yao Kim Lam is played by Jason Chong. Casting by Catapult Casting. Script translations by Yan Zhuang. Additional audio from Time Magazine, C-SPAN, Alux.com, Videlo Productions, NBC, Associated Press, Sky News UK, Journeyman Pictures, Channel 10, Channel 9, ABC, ABC America and CNN. The reading you heard at the start of this episode was an excerpt from Midnight Sun by Korean poet Kim Hae-soon, read by Jason Chong.